loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. President Trump, who never served in the military, has ordered the Pentagon to plan a large-scale military parade, and already people all over the country are expressing outrage. The press says he was awestruck by the French military parade. This parade may cost $20 to $25 million. It would take place perhaps on Veterans Day weekend, the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. We're going to talk about the glorification of war, the glorification of militarism, and what Donald Trump wants to do with this military parade. We're joined from Washington by Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And we're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Peter Kuznick, a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and the co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Kathy Kelly, let's start with you. The glorification of war and militarism are the only words I can think about this, but I'm also looking at Facebook, I'm looking at Twitter, I'm looking at email sharing online. It seems to me that if Donald Trump goes forward with this, which I think he wants to do, and he's directed the Pentagon to do it, I believe that hundreds of thousands of people who are against war and against racism are going to be descending on Washington, D.C. But let's just get your take on this announcement by Donald Trump that's dominating the news at the moment.
Well, I think that Donald Trump has certainly embraced militarism in a way that crowds out any possibilities we have to solve the very real problems we're all facing. We're facing huge problems with regard to environment, with regard to the disparities in income, with regard to the vulnerability of the United States to crumbling infrastructure. We could solve all of these problems, but we can't solve these problems and still embrace militarism almost as though it's a faith-based religion, because the militarization process keeps us in a permanent warfare state and keeps pouring our resources into the pockets of the military contractors, who will be only too happy to put themselves on display for a big, huge, ostentatious parade in Washington, D.C. And what a scandal to do that on the day when we ought to be celebrating Armistice Day, the understanding that the World War I tragedy was a squandering of lives, of bloodletting, and accomplished nothing that was good for humanity.
Dr. Peter Kuznick, it seems to me that this militarism and celebration of militarism has become the norm in our country. It's something that I don't recall growing up. I don't even recall after I became an adult, this celebration of war and war machines. Is this something that we're going to have to get used to? Is this something that's infecting both of our political parties?
Well, actually, I'm a little older than you, and I do recall this being an important part of American life in the 1950s and the early 1960s. The war that dominated our consciousness was World War II. It wasn't the Korean War. The Korean War was the beginning of America's failure as a dominant military force around the world. The Korean War started the realization that maybe military solutions don't work to these kinds of problems, but there was still a heroic, patriotic sense of World War II as a victory over fascism and Japanese militarism. But if you look at the America's history in warfare since World War II, it's really been one failure after another. The message that we should have received is that military solutions rarely, if ever, work. Sometimes they may be necessary, but that's something that should be the last resort. But there's this embrace of militarism. It's almost an inverse relationship. The poorer we do on the battlefield, the more we glorify the military. You look at the faith in American institutions. The popularity, the approval ratings for Congress are terrible. Advertising, business, very low. but the faith in the military is the one thing that people seem to be able to agree on. And so you don't have to go to military parades. You just turn on the Super Bowl. You turn on any football game, even baseball games. Fortunately, Peter Angelos and the Baltimore Orioles allow them to perform This Land Is Your Land, sometimes in the seventh inning stretch, but it's mostly this kind of patriotism, and a lot of it is associated with the military. And so, especially for somebody with the emotional maturity of a Donald Trump, you know, a kind of an eight-year-old with his finger on the nuclear button, who's going to be so impressed with this kind of pomp and ceremony and tanks and bombers. You know, that's the kind of person that would appeal to the most. But I think in terms of the overall American mentality, it's very, very corrosive, very dangerous, a glorification of the military at a time when diplomacy takes a backseat to military, to every military option and thinking in this administration. We can go on, but an administration that's being run by generals in a way that we haven't seen before.
Kathy Kelly, you know, the last time there were big military parades in the United States was at the end of the first Gulf War. For those of us who were organizing against the Gulf War, we knew that there was a lot of sentiment against the war in the run-up to the war. In fact, hundreds of thousands of people were demonstrating all the time. And then, of course, before the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, even greater numbers of people on February 15th, 2003, and that's another 15-year, the anniversary is coming up in a week, maybe 10 million people around the world demonstrated. And the New York Times at that time said there's a new second global superpower, and that's the People's Anti-War Movement. That movement, of course, dissipated in a not so long afterwards. But the first Gulf War was after the defeat of Iraq in the first Gulf War. I can remember with the confetti coming down in the lower Manhattan. We went there with anti-war leaflets. It was a sort of a war hysteria, fervor that people were whipped into. And I think the same thing happened probably in Washington, D.C. I wasn't here. But it was really, it was the glorification of war. It was a kind of triumphalism that sort of signaled the inauguration of a new era. The U.S. would be the global unipolar hegemon.
In fact, people said at the time that the ghosts of Vietnam were dead.
Yeah, and that's what George H.W. Bush, when he ran to the microphone after the end of the first Gulf War, said the Vietnam syndrome has finally been overcome, or I'm paraphrasing. But here, as you said, Kathy, here we have a situation where the Trump is going to spend $20 to $25 million on just a parade. And then the military budget of the United States is greater than the next 10 countries combined, and it's going up rapidly. And at this moment, people in Puerto Rico can't get drinking water. They don't have electricity. FEMA just stopped the contracts. Half of the bankruptcies in America are caused by people not being able to pay their doctor's bills.
Tens of thousands of homeless veterans.
Yeah, it's really, in addition to everything else, as you were starting to suggest, this is the looting of the country's wealth for militarism, and we're supposed to, in the name of patriotism, all genuflect at the altar of militarism, and we're saying, well, that's patriotic, that's what it means to love the country. And so it takes on almost a religious feel about it. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, you know, right before this conversation started on the radio show, there was just a quick exchange between Peter Kuznick and yourselves and me, and the three of us were saying, thank you, Peter, for your films. I think that at the core of the problem is education. The military-industrial complex, or you could say congressional military-industrial media complex, has a vice-like grip on education in this country. I'm not talking so much about institutional education, but the kind of education that Peter mentioned that happens at major sporting events, the idea that we're always supposed to be thankful for the service of the veterans. People don't really even think about actual wars, present or past. And so we need to use the tools that are there, and they are there. Peter's films, particularly we were thinking about the 1948 elections following a time when, you know, an election was manipulated by the people who were trying to promote further wars. We haven't get anything close to the budget that the military has for promoting militarization. But we do have the opportunities to get together with people in very grassroots, personal ways, and I think that we've got to exercise that as much as possible and then encourage people that there is something they can do. For instance, they can go to Washington, D.C. and protest if this November 11th plan develops or arrange protests in their own areas. Cindy Sheehan is calling for a women's march on the Pentagon in October of 2018. There are many, many ways in which people can organize themselves. It appears that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from Saudi Arabia will be coming over to the United States, and certainly he has pulled resources from Saudi Arabia into a war against Yemen, but the United States has certainly given the green light and plenty of support and joined in on that war. So there are many ways in which we can say we don't want to support this, as you say, looting of the United States resources, and to make it clear, the United States has no moral authority, no unique calling, no economic capacity to justify embracing permanent war and invading and occupying and bombing other nations.
Peter Kuznick is our other guest. That was Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Dr. Peter Kuznick, a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University and the co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, is our other guest. Peter, let's go back to you. And again, your series, which I hope, and the book that goes with it, I hope everybody gets a chance to read it and watch it, The Untold History of the United States. Let's go back to the idea of permanent war, because before World War II, the United States, while it had many military engagements since the, quote, birth of the nation, certainly didn't have a permanent war economy, and it wasn't engaged in permanent war. It didn't have, as it does now, maybe almost 1,000 military bases all over the world and troops all over the world. That all started in that period between 1945 and especially in the late 1940s, after the 1948 convention, and inaugurated especially with the advent of the Korean War. And here again, we have Donald Trump threatening total annihilation again of North Korea, because North Korea was virtually annihilated between 50 and 53. Talk about how the U.S. became addicted to war, became addicted to militarism, and how the permanent war economy and the military-industrial complex actually became a permanent feature of this society's life.
Well, you have to remember that in World War II, the Soviet Union was our ally. That despite the fact that most Americans don't remember this history, the Soviet Union was actually responsible for defeating the Nazis, defeating the Germans. Most Americans think the U.S. won the war in Europe, and of course that's not true. In fact, it was even the Soviet invasion of Japan that forced the Manchuria that forced the Japanese to surrender, as our official U.S. Navy Museum now states. Not the atomic bombings, but another part of the World War II mythology. So coming out of World War II, it was essential, if we were going to wage the Cold War in the ways that Truman wanted, you have to remember that Roosevelt and his vice president, Henry Wallace, did not want to have any kind of hostile relation with the Soviets. They thought we'd be friends after the war, but Truman reverses that quickly. But he's got to change the American mindset. So as Senator Vandenberg tells him, if you want to get the Truman Doctrine through and all that funding, you're going to have to scare hell out of the American people. So we begin to create this boogeyman image of the Soviet Union in the 1945, 46, 47 period. But this country was still not sold on militarism quite in the same way. We were racing ahead in terms of our nuclear arms, and then the Soviets test in August of 49, their first atomic bomb, the United States commits to developing the hydrogen bomb. And so now we're developing the capability in real time to end life on the planet, which we now know, which we've had now for over 60 years, so really since the atomic bombings in 45, at least in a theoretical sense. But the Korean War is pivotal, because before the Korean War, We proposed NSC 68. NHTSA was very involved in that. And there was opposition to that. It didn't look like the government was going to approve of that. But with the start of the Korean War, the United States is able to quadruple its military budget from that point on, go from about $12.5 billion to $50 billion through NSC 68. And it's at that point that the United States gets heavily involved in Southeast Asia. The United States gets involved in Indochina in overthrowing the Hucks in the Philippines. And so we're entering a whole new level of militarization. It's during the 50s under Eisenhower. You have to remember when Eisenhower took office, the United States had about 1,000 nuclear weapons. When Eisenhower left office 8 years later, the United States had more than 22,000 nuclear weapons. When his budgeting cycle was finished, we had over 30,000 nuclear weapons. So this is the period, despite Eisenhower's warnings about the military-industrial complex, this is the period when this totally lethal war machine gets built up on a massive scale. Eisenhower was able to warn against the military-industrial complex because he understood it better than anybody, because he was largely responsible for creating the military-industrial complex. And then we go through, you know, then with Vietnam, we could, of course, spend hours talking about the history of Vietnam. But the United States had been embarked on this military path for many, many decades, and Trump embraces it with a kind of openness that we hadn't seen before. Obama, who was feeding it in his own way, was much more circumspect, much more measured, understood the dangers of a heavier involvement in Syria, tried to pull U.S. troops in and out and end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What we see Trump doing now with his love of military, with his glorification of the military, is doubling down on all the bad things that Obama had done and creating a lot more of his own. The North Korean situation is largely of Trump's own making. Kim Jong-un deserves a lot of responsibility also for reckless policies. But Trump has created a much more dangerous situation in a number of these crucial hotspots that really have put us at risk, as part of why the bulletin atomic scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock back to 2 minutes before midnight. The last time they moved it to 2 minutes to midnight was 1953, after the U.S. and the Soviets both tested their hydrogen bombs. And I think they're right. I think we are in a very precarious situation right now, and people have got to be thinking about ways to solve these problems that are the opposite of glorification of the military. We see what Tillerson has done to diplomacy, to the State Department, with Trump's approval. The search, as Kathy was saying, for peaceful solutions to what our real problems are has been really silenced by the move toward militarization and search for military solutions.
Okay, and that's the voice of Dr. Peter Kuznick. I know Peter has a busy teaching schedule today, and we agreed that we would let him go a couple minutes before we come to an end. Peter is a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University and the co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. We're also joined by Kathy Kelly. Kathy, if you can remain with us for our last few minutes. And Dr. Kuznick, thanks so much
Thank
for
you.
Joining us. Thank you.
It's always good talking to you. Take
thanks.
Care.
Kathy Kelly, you have been to Afghanistan. You've been to Iraq. You've been, I believe, to Yemen. You've been to where the U.S. bombs are dropping. And one of the things that, because we talked about education before, the thing that the American people don't get, they certainly don't get it from the corporate-owned media, they don't get the sense of what the human dimension is of this policy or practice of endless war. The wars go on and on and on. There's no even definition of victory anymore. There's not a conception of what victory means in Iraq or Afghanistan. The wars have their own logic, their own thinking, and their own incentive, and yet millions of people, literally millions of people, are paying this heavy toll, and to a large extent, the American people are more or less kept in the dark. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, you know, I haven't been to Yemen, but I've been certainly aware of the commonalities right now between Yemen, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and they play out in such painful, painful ways. You know, the last time I was in Afghanistan, two different young people came over, burst into tears, and said, "The well has dried up. My family has no access to water." In Yemen, lowered water tables were, you know, part of a rising chorus of grievances that people had because the elite cronies, many of them sworn militarists, were commandeering the nation's resources, and people were becoming more and more desperate. And, you know, in Iraq, we see this same kind of desperation played out so painfully. I'm aware of, you know, families who are trying to get their loved ones out of horrible hostage situations, where families that have been displaced and are broken apart, families that are still suffering from the bereavement all through the economic sanctions and through the bombings, the loss of their loved ones, the loss of a future. Education has tanked. I can't find a word strong enough to say how horrible education has become in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and in Yemen. And so a younger generation arises undereducated, often poorly fed, sometimes brain damaged because of chronic malnutrition, traumatized to the maximum in ways people in the United States couldn't imagine. It would be their worst nightmare. And this is what militarism has procured for people in other lands that the United States doesn't even think about anymore. People don't even realize we're still at war in Afghanistan. We still have troops in Iraq that we're bombing Yemen. It's certainly an important month to focus on the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He made it so clear that a nation that has poured its resources into military solutions is approaching spiritual death, that we're a society gone mad on war. And the hopes of people who are impoverished by war just get battered again and again and again. Dr. King said America would never invest the necessary funds to end poverty so long as military adventures continue to draw people and skills and money like some demonic, destructive suction tube. Dr. Kuznick mentioned the Korean War, and there's a novel by Jane Ann Larkin called Jane Ann Phillips called Lark and Termite. And a soldier is just so lonely and sick of war and wants to come home. And he sees another warplane flying overhead, and he says, "The planes fly like planets on rotation. They keep coming like planets on rotation, a timed bloodletting with different excuses." And I think that's what our foreign wars and interventions represent, a timed bloodletting with different excuses.
Very good words, and very important to remember. This is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. The year before, exactly 1 year to the day, April 4th, 1967, when he made his speech at Riverside Church against the war in Vietnam, which was a very courageous stance because it cost him some support, considerable support for the civil rights movement. He did that, and he said at that time, "Our government, my government," as he called it, "is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world." And those are strong, strong words. We have a situation, John, where Dr. King is saluted, is celebrated. We remember his birthday every year as a consequence of people's demand that it be commemorated as a national holiday. That's good. But we don't really, on those anniversaries, or if you go to the Martin Luther King Memorial here in Washington, D.C., you don't see those kind of quotes. "My government is the greatest purveyor of violence." And yet, when you think about it, here we are 50 years later. The U.S. is spending way more on military than it did during the height of the Vietnam War. And we just marked, you and I, John, just marked with another show this week, the anniversary, 15th anniversary, February 5th or 5th of 2003, when Colin Powell made his presentation to the U.N. and convinced or tried to convince the world that Iraq posed a grave and menacing danger to world peace because it had weapons of mass destruction. That was all a lie. But, you know, every time the U.S. goes to war, it has to assign a noble cause for the war: to stop weapons of mass destruction, to protect civilians, you know, to fight for democracy, something. It doesn't say we're doing this because we're addicted to war, we're addicted to militarism, and we use the military as our way to maintain, we, the United States, maintain our supremacy in world politics. But when you cut through all the BS, the bad sociology, the propaganda, that's really what this is about. We have about 2 minutes left. John, why don't you, I want to get your reaction to that, and then let's have Kathy have the last word.
You bet. I think one of the great shames of the last 40, even 50 years is that while we have elevated Dr. King into the pantheon of true and great American heroes, we've largely forgotten his message beyond Human Rights, Voting Rights Act, et cetera. You know, my kids are in elementary school and middle school. And of course, they learn about Martin Luther King at a young age. They learn of the great work that he did in Selma and in Montgomery. And they learn about the I Have a Dream speech. And then that's it. Their education of Martin Luther King ends right there. And they just don't talk about him again. This is something that we've lost in our country, because we ought to be looking now, not just in our elementary schools, but all of us ought to be looking now for the wisdom of Martin Luther King, the wisdom that he passed on to us in the 1960s for leadership today.
Kathy Kelly, we have about just a little bit less than a minute. How can people do something with the Voices for Creative Nonviolence? I'm looking at a Facebook page called Mobilize Against Trump's Military Parade, but that's going to be coming if they actually have it on Veterans Day. What can people do to show support or learn about your work and how they can get involved in the anti-war and peace movement?
Well, I think that the usage of drones being operated by pilots in bases all across the United States deserves plenty of attention. People are active in Syracuse, New York, in Niagara, New York, in Madison, Wisconsin, in Los Angeles, in Nevada, all over the United States. People are calling attention to the new wave of militarism, if you will, which places faith in robotic warfare. And it means there aren't so many soldiers being deployed, but this doesn't mean that the killing has been reduced. I think that it's important to go out to these military bases. Now, it's a very cold day here in Chicago, so it's a bit odd to think about peace gardens. But our friends in Afghanistan plant peace gardens deliberately as a way to say that they recognize that war destroys the land, that the ordnance left over destroys the land, that people are displaced by the war and they can't cultivate the land. And so if there's any way to go to a military base in your area and just dig nearby, as close as you can, dig to plant at least a few plants in solidarity. That's one thing I'd recommend.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it right. We've been joined from Chicago by Kathy Kelly. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. We were also joined by Dr. Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and the co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The United Nations is warning that Gaza will run out of fuel in only 10 days, already causing hospitals to close. Meanwhile, an Israeli paper reported that Saudi Arabia granted overflight clearance to Air India's new flight from Delhi to Tel Aviv, though Saudi Arabia is now denying it. And the Israeli government is preparing to expel as many as 40,000 African refugees. We are joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Welcome back, Ali.
Thank you.
Let's talk first, and we're going to cover a number of subjects here in this on this important issue. But let's first start with Gaza. The United Nations is warning that Gaza will run out of fuel in 10 days. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's already run out of fuel. In particular, as of yesterday, the health ministry had announced that 19 health facilities, including 16 primary care clinics and 3 major hospitals, had run out of emergency fuel for their backup generators. Now, these hospitals are relying on backup generators because Israel severely restricts the electricity supply to Gaza to just a few hours a day as part of its decade-long siege on the territory. And what has happened is these hospitals have run out of their emergency supplies of fuel. They are unable to perform surgeries. Hundreds of dialysis patients, a life-threatening situation. Pediatric patients and children, basically, in pediatric intensive care. Their lives at risk, according to doctors at the Al-Nasr Children's Hospital in Gaza. And up to 200 surgeries or procedures a day are having to be postponed because blood supplies, donated blood, is going bad because it cannot be refrigerated. Now, this is a particularly acute episode in, I have to stress, the long-term and systematic destruction of Gaza's healthcare system by Israel's siege. And, you know, what happens is that these horrific crises occur and then, you know, the so-called international community steps in to provide just enough fuel to keep things going for a few more weeks, although that hasn't happened yet in this case. And then, you know, at the same time, the situation keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And in the meantime, according to human rights organizations and the UN, in 2017, Israel tightened the siege on Gaza in many ways, including reducing even further the number of medical permits it gives to Palestinians who need life-saving treatment to go to the West Bank or to hospitals in Israel or other countries because they can't get that treatment in Gaza. So that the number of medical permits approved has fallen, according to the UN, to the lowest level since 2006. So in short, while destroying the healthcare system inside Gaza, Israel is also making it much harder for Palestinians confined to Gaza to get life-saving treatment outside the territory.
That's the big story, John. And of course, the headlines don't capture it.
No.
I mean, I want to encourage our listeners to go to electronicintifada.net, Ali's website. There's an article there, Slow Death for Gaza Cancer Patients Cut Off from Care. Here's a young man, early 20s. I'm only a cancer patient. What threat do I pose? Mm-hmm. Asked Khalil Abdullah, news that Augusta Victoria Hospital would no longer receive new patients has been extremely worrying for Khalil Abdullah. The 21-year-old cancer patient in the occupied Gaza Strip is the sole breadwinner for a family of six, a painter and decorator. Abdullah had to stop working when he was diagnosed with cancer and underwent surgery. You know, when you have a government systematically depriving cancer patients of care, systematically and as a matter of policy, and then that same government receives the biggest, it's the biggest recipient of U.S. military and economic aid, that would be
in the world.
That would be the government of Israel. This is nothing other than a grandiose crime against humanity, but nobody calls it that.
No.
I mean, the language is so, I don't know, so trivializing what's going on.
We're talking about the deaths of, or potential deaths of a lot of people. Ali notes on his website here that that 16 primary care clinics and three major hospitals are already out of fuel. And he says in an article that Gaza hospitals are currently unable to carry out 200 operations per day due to the destruction and the waste of hundreds of units of blood because of a lack of required cooling. That's inexcusable.
Yeah, well, you know, you said nobody calls it a crime. In fact, they do. You know, human rights groups and legal experts point out that Israel, as the occupying power in Gaza, and it still is the occupying power, even though they claim they withdrew in 2005, the International Committee of the Red Cross considers Israel the occupying power because their standard is that Israel still maintains effective control over Gaza, and boy, do they maintain control. No one can get it in or out of Gaza without Israeli permission. Nothing can get in and out of Gaza. So it's an occupied territory, and Israel as the occupying power is required under the Fourth Geneva Convention. And remember, that the Geneva Conventions come out of the horrors of World War II. They were adopted in 1949 to avoid the horrors of World War I or World War II, in which 100 million people were killed in the most inhumane conditions in wars. And what they state is that the occupying power is required to do everything within its power to provide for the needs of the civilian population, including public health, sanitation, water, food, and so on, and to do nothing to impede medical care. Now, not only is Israel, you know, Israel's not just failing to do that because it's incapable. Everyone knows Israel is capable. Israel is deliberately depriving Palestinians in Gaza of basic health care services, of the right to life and the right to health, as a form of political blackmail. And you don't have to take my word for it, because the Israeli defense minister says it clearly. General Yoav Mordechai, the head of the so-called civil administration, that's basically the Israeli occupation bureaucracy, says it clearly, that we're not going to let Gaza have more electricity. We're not going to let Gaza rebuild. We're not going to ease the siege until we get what we want. And what they're demanding is progress, as they call it, on the release of Israelis held in Gaza. There are two or three Israelis held there, and there are two bodies believed to be held there of two occupation soldiers from the 2014 invasion of Gaza. And so they're basically holding 2 million people, 1 million of them children, hostage for these Israelis. But of course, there's no evidence. I mean, you know, there's no evidence also that you can appease Israel into easing the conditions. And we know that because in October, Hamas handed over the control of the border crossing, or the checkpoint with Israel, Erez checkpoint, to the Palestinian Authority under a so-called reconciliation deal backed by the international community. So they're doing what is asked of them. And according to the UN, it has made absolutely zero difference in the number of people allowed in and out of Gaza. So the message there is you cannot surrender your way into appeasing Israel and getting Israel to ease the prison conditions, the ghetto conditions on 2 million people in Gaza.
Yeah. You know, switching tacks a little bit too, I've been interested in the fact that, well, first in the rumors that the Israelis and the Saudis have significantly improved their relations of late. Of course, they don't have official or formal diplomatic relations, but there have been rumors for many months, more than a year even, of secret and discreet contact between the two. Now we have news that the Saudis have allowed overflight clearance for a new Air India flight between Delhi and Tel Aviv. This is a first. No other airlines on their way to Israel have been allowed to fly over Saudi territory. What do you make of this, and how does it impact Palestinians who are in the occupied territories?
Well, the big picture is that, there's two sides to this. One is it's a sign of the growing relationship between India and Israel, between the Hindu nationalist anti-Muslim government of India and Israel, who are getting tighter with sort of chauvinistic, ultra-nationalist, ultra-religious nationalist politics. They're making arms deals and so on. There were these mutual visits by Netanyahu and by the Indian Prime Minister to each other's countries in recent months. So that's one element of it. Of course, the Saudi element is the big story. And there's no secret here. You know, Israel and the so-called moderate Sunni countries led by Saudi Arabia have been in an alliance that has been nurtured by the United States since before Trump, but also particularly after Trump, whose goal is to form a sectarian alliance against Iran to beat back the perceived strategic threat of Iran. And that's been pretty much explicit. It's a policy that you know, the young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has adopted with gusto. And that was something that Michael Wolff discussed in his book, Fire and Fury. But it's something that, you know, didn't gain much traction in the mainstream media, with their brains addled by Russiagate and the obsession with the phantom of Russia and Hillary Clinton's defeat. So that the signs have been there for a long time. It's not just between Saudi Arabia and Israel, but also Bahrain. We've seen the king of Bahrain, and Bahrain is effectively a vassal of Saudi Arabia, making statements criticizing the boycott of Israel. There was a Bahraini normalization delegation that went to Jerusalem a couple of months ago and was greeted with protests by Palestinians. They were blocked from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound by Palestinians, who basically told them, "You came via Israel, you know, don't come to us." What we also see is that these Gulf Arab regimes see Israel, see Tel Aviv, as the route to Washington's heart, to the Trump administration's heart. So, in the dispute between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, another big ally of Israel, on the one hand, and Qatar on the other hand, what we have seen is Qatar trying to one-up the Saudis by courting the most extreme pro-Israel and Zionist groups in Washington with a major charm offensive. Recently, they've welcomed in Doha Alan Dershowitz and the head, Morton Klein, the president of the Zionist Organization of America, and others as part of this charm offensive to win the support of the Trump administration. So that's all sort of the context for this move, which regarding the air rights, which, by the way, has been a major demand of Israel for many, many years, to allow overflights. Israel considers that a major prize because it's a sign of, you know, normalization and quote-unquote peaceful relations.
That's the voice of Ali Abu Nima. He's with the Electronic Intifada. Ali, speaking of normalizing relations or normalizing Israel's presence or its practices, let's talk a little bit about Egypt, if we could. Of course, the 1979 Camp David summit or Camp David treaty was a major blow for the Palestinian people. It took the largest Arab army outside of resistance and made Egypt a collaborator with Israel to maintain the peace, freeing Israel up to do everything, including the subsequent invasion of Lebanon shortly thereafter. There are reports now that the al-Sisi government in Egypt has quietly given the nod to the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, to carry out scores, perhaps hundreds of airstrikes in the Sinai inside of Egypt. It doesn't publicly acknowledge it. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, of course, you know, the tie between Israel and Egyptian elites goes back to the peace treaty and just before it, when, you know, the Egyptian elites basically threw Palestinians, the Palestinian cause, under the bus, broke their ties with the Soviet Union and decided to get fully on board with Israel and the United States. And since then, of course, with Mubarak and even with the Muslim Brotherhood, a brief Muslim Brotherhood presidency of Mohamed Morsi, the one thing that there was a consensus on was maintaining the treaty with Israel. And after the military coup in July 2013, which brought Sisi to power in Cairo, you'll remember there was this whole kerfuffle in Washington about whether to call this coup a coup, because the U.S. law is that if it's called a coup, then U.S. aid would have to be suspended under American law. So there was a great deal of lobbying from, friends of Egypt, in particular AIPAC, the powerful Israel lobby group, of the Obama administration, not to call this a coup, so that the aid could continue to Egypt, because Egypt is viewed as such an important asset to Israel's control of the region. And that's what happened. And You know, so Sisi really owes his position and his relationship with the United States to Israel and its lobby, and will certainly do nothing to shake that relationship. And the revelations of the New York Times in recent weeks include not just these dozens of airstrikes, which, by the way, show that Sisi and Egypt, despite, you know, putting on this big bravado of military parades and so on, are not really even able to control Egyptian territory. They have to call in Israel to try and help them. And prior to that, you know, a couple of weeks before, the New York Times, David Kirkpatrick had revealed that in the context of Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, a decision that was overwhelmingly rejected by the whole world, the Sisi dictatorship in Egypt, its intelligence agencies had been contacting, you know, celebrities and public figures in Egypt and telling them basically, you know, this was an effort to shape public opinion by influencing celebrities, telling them Jerusalem's not such a big deal, the Palestinians can have their capital in Ramallah. So really, that was another sign of the depth of the symbiosis or parasitic relationship, might be a better description, between the Egyptian regime and the Egyptian elites on the one hand and Israel on the other.
Can I just ask you a follow-up question on that? Because we had the era for, not only for Egypt, but the larger pan-Arab movement that began with Nasser's taking power in the early 1950s, and then the relationship that existed between Egypt and the Soviet Union that began to fray following Nasser's death under Sadat and finally terminated, as you discussed, by the mid and late 1970s with the signing of the Camp David. Why would Egypt, the largest Arab country and the country with the largest army, why would the elites feel it necessary or advantageous to fasten themselves to this constellation of relationships? Why is that better for them?
Well, their priority, and, you know, others who are much more expert in Egypt than I am, like Professor Joseph Mansard at Columbia University, have written about this. You know, the priority of Egyptian elites, and that includes the army, the top army brass, is to pillage the country and enrich themselves. And this, for them, has been the most advantageous constellation to continue to enrich themselves while the rest of Egypt, a country of, what, 80, 90 million people, is living in the most abject poverty. I mean, it's just shocking when you go to Cairo or you go to other parts of Egypt and see the levels of poverty in Egypt. And this poverty isn't just something that happens. It's the result of a policy of denying to poor Egyptians and to the majority of Egyptian people the fruits of the country's wealth. And that's a situation which these elites wish to maintain and see the relationship with the United States as crucial to that. And, of course, the relationship with Israel is part and parcel of that constellation.
Right. You know, I wonder, too, about this new Israeli policy regarding Africans. You know, we've been talking about the Palestinians, and frankly, there's this new story, new over the last year or so, that's really, it seems to be coming to a head. The Israelis have announced that they are going to expel the first 20,000 of as many as 40,000 African refugees. These are non-Jewish African refugees. Now, many of these refugees face terrible demises in places like Libya, for example, or Mali or Nigeria if they're sent back to their countries. The Israelis have ignored a request from the United Nations to reconsider this policy, and these deportations are supposed to be starting imminently. What can you tell us about these deportations, and is there any recourse for any of these refugees?
Well, the important thing to understand, the background to this has been a years-long campaign of incitement by Israel's top leaders, something we've covered in great depth at the Electronic Intifada. My colleague David Sheen has written about this for us over many years. It's a campaign of incitement from the top down, from Netanyahu down, against African refugees and asylum seekers. It's an explicitly racist campaign. I mean, the language that they use is shocking, and it's something that we have documented on film and video at the Electronic Intifada. But it's important to understand that it is racist. It's not just because they're non-Jewish. It's also because they're black, or particularly because they're black, because there are hundreds of thousands of people who are non-Jews who came from the former Soviet Union over the years that, you know, ultimately turned out to be not Jewish enough for Israel. But there is no mass deportation of them. The mass deportations target solely Africans. And there was a stage in the past few years where they were placed in what was frankly called in Israel a concentration camp, a Holocaust camp in the desert. And there have been reports, although these are officially denied, but there have been consistent reports in the Israeli media that Israel has made deals with several African regimes. Some of those that have been mentioned have been Uganda and Rwanda, to actually essentially trade in Africans, where it works like this, where for every African asylum seeker or refugee, many of these people are from Eritrea or Sudan, countries where it's dangerous for them to go back. So they will be sent to Rwanda, and Rwanda receives a payment of $5,000, or Uganda. Those are the kinds of things that have been reported in the Israeli press, though again, officially denied. And there have been reports that some of these regimes have been getting, you know, arms deals from Israel in exchange for taking people. And the other part of the context here is Israel's effort to push into Africa to sort of make better relations with these African dictatorships in order to, you know, to try to reduce the automatic overwhelming majority in support of Palestinian rights in the UN General Assembly. So in the vote in December in the General Assembly, I think one or two of these countries that Israel has been working on either voted with it, Togo, I believe, or abstained. So that's also part of the context here.
Ali Abu Nima is our guest. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. You can read his writings and the writings of others at electronicintifada.net. Ali is also the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. We have a little less than 2 minutes left, Ali. The Israeli courts are taking up a lawsuit against New Zealanders who had written a letter to Lorde, the singer, who urging her not to play Israel. And she learned about the boycott, the BDS movement, and she decided not to play. Now the Israeli courts are using the legal system to sue the people who wrote her an open letter. It wasn't even a private letter. It was an open letter encouraging her to boycott Israel. Again, this obviously shows that the government of Israel and its supporters over here are really, really alarmed about boycott, divest, sanctions, a peaceful movement, a movement of conscience, a movement like what happened to help end apartheid in South Africa. Just talk about what the stakes are for both sides. 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Well, this is crazy. You know, basically, under an Israeli law, they're trying to sue New Zealanders for exercising their free speech rights in New Zealand. So this would be like someone in Israel trying to sue you for exercising your First Amendment rights here in the United States. It's obviously totally absurd. But again, it does show the desperation of Israel to try to defame and scare people into silence. And what I think is notable about this alleged lawsuit, because two activists targeted, one Jewish and one Palestinian New Zealander, have received no summons or any formal notice. I mean, they're over in New Zealand. They're nowhere near Israel. Israeli courts have no jurisdiction over them. But the group that announced that it was filing this lawsuit is called Shirat Hadin. And really, the only thing you need to know about Shirat Hadin is that it has admitted that it has acted as a front for Mossad, Israel's spying and assassination agency. So really, this litigation or this threat of litigation should be seen as part of an oppressive state's efforts to interfere in other countries, in the politics and civil life of other countries, in order to shut people up and to pursue its own cause. And hey, you know what? It's another example of Israelgate that no one wants to talk about.
That's all the time we have. We've been joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. You can read his writings at electronicintifada.net. He is also the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back with the big stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.